Good afternoon, everyone. I'll go ahead and call the Senate and Interim Committee on Judiciary to order.
And I'll open and call to order the House Interim Judiciary Committee.
Thank you very much. We're going to do a couple of changes here on our agenda, but first let me start off for those attorneys who may be in the room who are looking for CLE credit. There is a sign-up sheet over close to the door. I would ask that you, if you're wanting to get credit as an attorney for MCLE, please sign up appropriately. The other thing we're going to do is we have as you can see, not all of our members present. A lot of them have multiple different activities that they're doing today. So we're going to first have another opportunity to have some words, hopefully all kind. They may not all be kind. For Representative Hicks, who is no longer going to be with us. He is going to be taking on new endeavors as county council down in Josephine County. And so with that, Mr. Chair, did you want to go ahead and start the roast? I'm assuming the discussion?
Well, yeah, we'll call it a discussion, but those of you who have worked with Representative Hicks, he's a fine young man. We were so happy to see him come, or not happy to see him go. But I don't know how many of you were here at his first meeting. It was quite comical because he actually was leaning out over the dais, cross-examining this person about the topic in hand. And we were all watching Andy Olson. Said, "What's he doing?" He says he's being an attorney. You know, so you know, for me, Wally. I have part of Josephine County, so I'll be seeing you once in a while because it's in my district, but you're going to be hard to replace. Many people, we don't replace them. We just don't. So hope you do well on your new assignment.
Thank you.
And Representative Tomei, this is going to be, I think, your last...
This is my last meeting.
Yeah, and you're going to get to do some motions,
yes.
Bill introductions. And everyone knows that her and I have had a go-round or two.
Did you tell your wife?
Yes, I did. But we did meet in the hall one day, and somehow we ended up hugging each other. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
And I had, at the end of the judiciary year, we have usually a dinner or something. One of the things I said at our dinner was that Representative Tomei is probably one of the more attentive person in a committee, watching what's being said, taking notes, and then asking pertinent questions of what's going on. If we were all doing that, we would be getting through this process a lot faster. So I really appreciate the work that you've done over the years.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I love being here.
Any other House members have any comments that you might want to share?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Well, I will start with Representative Tomei. As a woman legislator, you have led the way on many issues in this building, and we appreciate you and the work that you've done, and those of us who are coming after you. And you are the conscience of the House, I believe, and of this committee, and as somebody who is always asking how the work that we do will impact those most vulnerable in our state. And we will miss you for being that advocate and keeping the lawyers from lawyering up too much in this committee. When you say, wait a second, I don't, you know, explain that in English. You also are the person who kept us warm by always saying it's freezing in here, make sure you turn up the heat. So we appreciate that. But I will miss, most of all, times when we got to drink tequila together. So many good things were done over tequila with Representative Tomei. And for Representative Hicks, I will say, working out the I heard somebody say, it's the whiskey. Working out the public safety work that we did last session, we couldn't have done it without you, making it a bipartisan effort, looking at rural and urban settings for the work that we were doing. It was your voice was invaluable, and we did work out most of that package over whiskey, so thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I got to know Representative Tomei when I was a Clackamas County Commissioner, and we were working on mental health issues. And as a new state representative, I've had a chance to see your leadership on issues related to the state hospital, and I've had the chance to see how, with your grace and dignity and tenacity, you are able to cross all kinds of boundaries and unite and find, you know, teamwork with people from all kinds of perspectives. And I remember the last time we all sat together as a joint body, you and Senator Cruz, who I've had the pleasure of talking to for the last few minutes, were both really energized about a state hospital issue and people being sent there perhaps when other places would be more cost efficient and more humane. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree. And I thought to myself, darn it, that is proof right there that we can find the common ground to do great, crucial work, regardless of who we're sitting next to and regardless of how we see some other issues. So thank you for being that role model. And Senator Cruz, I look forward to continuing that good work with you. And similarly, Representative Hicks, you have done a great job in the time that I've known you on the Judiciary Committee of modeling how we don't have to agree on every issue to be extremely important colleagues to one another. And I've heard Representative Williamson and Barton and Tomei and everyone talk about what a great colleague they are and how much they like you and respect your views. And, you know, I'm hoping to be a legislator for whom people say similar stuff wherever they are on the political spectrum. So thanks and best wishes.
Thank you. Any other comments? We'll start with Senator Roblin, and we'll work our way this way.
So I'll start with Representative Hicks. It was really great to get to know you more. It was great as one of the co-speakers, but last session in the Joint Committee on Public Safety, you and I and our current, he's an appeals court judge, would get together and talk, and both of them helped me as a non-lawyer understand issues a little bit better, and sometimes you had to get relaxed to do that. So I appreciate all the time that you spent with us, and I do appreciate both your humor, your attentiveness to detail, and your willingness to share your knowledge with those less gifted like myself that had to figure out and understand exactly what people were saying, and you were sat next to me and would quietly let me know exactly what was going on when I didn't understand. I really do appreciate that. And for those of you who were here when we had co-speakerhood, Representative Tomei was the first person to ask me out on a date when I came as a freshman legislator because she knew I was by myself and my wife was back home, and what was I supposed to do in a place like Salem, which I didn't know about. So there's the Elsinore Theater, and she would get a group of us and we'd go down and watch some movies and do some other stuff, and I have always appreciated her. She was also, as they said, the conscience of the House, and if I got out of line, didn't matter what job I had, she told me directly, and she's always been direct. And I appreciate that. And she was one of those people that showed that you can have joint chairmanships of committees, and it's not always easy. And it's really not easy for two people trying to be co-speakers, to mediate between two people, both of whom we liked. So, but it was a great opportunity. And again, the issues that come up when you're dealing with Representative Tomei are ones that are at her core. And she is willing to negotiate and talk about a lot of things, but when you get down to that core, there's no place to go because she has this very strong belief about what's right and wrong in those places, and it's good to have those people who stand firm at different times when it would be easier for some of us if they wouldn't. But at the end of the day, it really worked out, and I'm really impressed and have been with you since the first day I met you. So thank you for all the time.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Senator Cruz. Yeah.
Carolyn? consumption of adult beverages and then everything seems right, makes a lot of sense. I don't consume adult beverages, so they make sense on a different level to me. We have agreed on, we have worked on a lot of stuff over the years. You're actually one, when I heard that you weren't running again, I was disappointed.
Thank you.
And because, we disagree on a lot of stuff, and we always will, but we've always been friends. And where we have, like Rep. Menginger said, we have some very common passions, and I'm sorry to lose somebody with that passion on the House side for the issues that we've cared about for a long time. So I hope you come and visit. I really do. We get trapped into RD stuff, and to a large degree, that's a bunch of hooey. Yes. So on a lot of things. Now, Mr. Hicks. I've never understood why you're always smiling. This place isn't always that much fun. Wally, he's been on Judish when I've been on Judish, and we've worked on a lot of stuff together. But I'm tasking you, Wally, that you need to keep an eye on what we're doing up here, because we're going to depend on you to help inform us as to how the impacts in rural Oregon and our small timber counties that are broke are going to be. So, so I'm looking forward to and actually encouraging your input as we move forward in this. And I'm going to miss you too. But we're neighbors, so.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, so it's barely been a year that I've been away, that I have not been a House member. But it's really going to hurt to lose both of you. I can't think, just on a personal note, I can't think of two people that I have more affection for and that I'll miss more than you two. And on the sort of larger public sense, whenever people question the value of government and the kind of service that people who are elected to office do, I would just point out you two as people who demonstrate that, yeah, the system works. We can elect good people and people who can make a difference. And I just thank you for, you know, really creating that model, which I'm going to remember for a long time.
Thank you.
So, Representative Tomei, we are passed across multiple times. We've had the opportunity to work very close together on many issues, and as you've heard, sometimes even though we may be on the same team, we may have some difference of opinions, but we always were able to get, I think, a product that we were both very pleased with that moved forward a lot of the issues that need to still be addressed. I know that you'll continue to bird dog us and make certain that some of the areas that you've been very passionate about will still be on the table, and that you're holding us accountable, and I appreciate that you'll be that person, that voice in the future. And we will be missing the styling of the glasses. I've been told I need to get some new readers that have a little bit more flash to them. So I will do my best to try to make that. Representative Hicks, I think it was back in the late 90s when we first were introduced by a phone call. You were thinking about leaving the district attorney. Well, you're thinking about running while you're still in the district attorney's office and serving the legislature. I found the hard way that once I got elected, I had to give up my day job in the Lane County District Attorney's Office. But I'm glad that you made that work for your family and for yourself to be able to come and be part of this process, because I know that your voice of reason, your voice of understanding as to what is important to ensure for many people within the broader, not only legislative, but criminal justice system is very, very important. And so your new endeavor will give you, as Senator Cruz said, an opportunity to work with us at the level of ensuring that whatever we do here is going to be a benefit for individuals throughout the state, counties such as Josephine that are struggling, as many of us know of all these other counties that are suffering so much because of just the financial inability to make ends meet. So I hope that your new endeavor is one that you will remember us and keep us informed. And I'm hoping that you will introduce us to your special assistant today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. This is Josephine, and she recently turned 4. And Grandma was going to be watching her this afternoon, but sometimes things don't always follow through that way. She said that she wanted to come with me. She's always protested my departures from home to come and do this service. And so this being my last trip north, I said, okay, last week, I said, if you're good for the next week, you can come with me this time. And she was. And so this is her reward. And here she sits. I know.
Oh, maybe in about 20 years you'll be back here helping.
Who knows? Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe, maybe. Josephine, how old do you have to be president? It's your chance.
35.
All right, 31 people, years.
Yeah, she's got a few. People always say when they leave political assignments, public office and the like, they're doing it for their family. And certainly that's accurate for me, except in this case with judiciary. Anybody who's been on this committee gets it real quick. And but this committee and this process around this committee is as much of a family as anything I've ever been connected with. Truly it is. Legislative service, the job of being a legislator, the identity and the role, it has its ups and has its downs. And like any other thing you do, you know, it's the people you work with that you that make all the difference while you're doing it and that you remember either way afterward. And so the people that are involved, particularly in the judiciary lane of this lawmaking process, if being a legislator consisted of doing nothing but being on this committee, I would do this till kingdom come. Truly, I would. And what a great honor this has been in my life. And as I go forward to other adventures, I am sure I will always value this as being the best job, this being on this committee, I mean, the best job I've ever had. So what an honor. Thank you for including me in your family. And I look forward to whatever lies ahead.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, did you want to make any comments?
Not really.
Okay. But
when I was asked to be on this committee, I was not a lawyer, had never been to law school, knew nothing about judiciary committee or laws. And like, obviously, you came well prepared. I was not prepared, but I loved it from the moment I came in. That wasn't true of other committees I've been on, but this is fascinating. And it is interesting. Jennifer and I were talking before we opened the meeting about how we would see the same faces over and over again. Some of you, not so often, but some of you almost once a week or maybe every day, four days a week. And it has created such a family. I've enjoyed that a lot. It's one of the committees. Other than my own community. Yeah. This was my second most favorite. I really appreciate being invited to be on this committee and serving with all of you. It has been a terrific experience.
Well, thank you. So what we're going to do is deviate a little bit from the agenda. We had planned on doing bill introductions toward the end, but as you can hear, some of the members are not going to be able to stay with us the full time. So at this point, the Senate is going to take a slight recess. We'll stand at ease. That will be, in other words, for all of us senators, we'll just stay here. We will not leave the room. And we'll pass the gavel over to...
I will be opening a work session in a minute, but I want to ask an opinion. You look at the weather outside... One of the worst storms in years on the coast. How many of you think it's fair that Chair Barker's in Hawaii?
I agree.
I was going to announce his cell phone number, but Senator Provansky said it would be improper.
Well, you know, we actually thought he was going to join us, but you know, maybe you can give out the cell phone number.
Okay, I'm going to open the House Committee on Judiciary, and that it will be in opening a work session for the purpose of introduction of bills. I want to make sure that that these are concepts and they are not in any way indicative of the members' desire to support that particular piece of legislation. And that's not that will take place when we actually start having testimony on those particular bills. It simply is getting these bills into the process. You don't have to vote for those bills when they come through. So with that in mind, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to point out that in the Human Services Committee, which we held yesterday, we had maybe six or eight bills. I want to point out to you, this is double fun in here too. So just bear with me. Representative Krieger, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 225, dated 8/25/14, 226, 6/16/14, 227, 6/17/14, 249, 5/6/14, 250, 5/6/14, 251, 5/8/14, 252, 5/7/14, 253, 5/7/14, 254, 5/7/14, 255, 5/7/14, 256, 5/7/14, 53014, 257 53014, 258 53014, 299 101614, 336 91714, 359 102214, 360 dated 102214, 370 dated 101614, 544 dated 102114, 545 dated 62514, 546 dated 61814, 549 101514, 554 dated 111014, 556 dated 72414, 558 7314, 559 717014, 560 dated 101314, 564 dated 7214, 708 72814, 709 7914, 725 71514, 726 71414, 889 dated 9-15-14, 975 dated 11-12-14, 987 dated 12-10-14, 988 11-14-14, 989 11-14-14, 12-18 9-23-14, 12-19 dated 11-4-14, 12-47 11-25-14, 12-54 dated 12-9-14, 13-43 dated 10-2-14, 13-47 10-28-14, 13-49 dated 2-5-14, 14-49 dated 10-16-14, 14-93 dated 11-4-14, 14-94 dated 12-9-14, 15-76 10-24-14, 15-89 dated 10-22-14, 2015 12-2-14, 2057 dated 11-21-14, 2058 dated 11-18-14, 2061 dated 11-21-14, 2067 dated 10-9-14, 2068 dated 10-9-14, 2070 dated 10-10-14, 2071 dated 12-2-14, 2073 11-7-14, 2555 dated 11-24-14, 2558 dated 10-20-14, 2560 dated 10-20-14, 2561 12-2-14, 2687 dated 10-9-14, 2689 10-7-14, 2740 dated 12-9-14, 2893 dated 12-3-14, 2894 dated 12-3-14. Obi, I've got your new job.
Representative Tomei has moved to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion?
Wait, I think maybe I missed a
No, you had one. I just checked. We have a
You have a different one.
There's a different list.
I know, but they had 1247 and we have 1247.
All right.
In both places. Or
I'll find that out and fix it.
We'll do both,
and we'll figure out.
Okay. Okay. Sure. Just checking for.
Okay. Is there any discussion on those? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so moved. And I guess we can close the work session on the introduction of bills.
And the Senate and our Judiciary Committee open up a work session for the purpose of bill introductions. And as Chair Krieger said, this is not a support vote. These are votes to introduce a measure. A concept does not mean that any of the members in the future will be supporting them if and when they come before a committee for up or down votes or on the floor. But this is just the process, as most of you know, as to allow for the opportunity for various bills that have been requested by members, by special interest groups, by lobbyists, by agencies, or anyone else that wanted to get something into the hopper, an opportunity to get in that process. So with that, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. 187 dated 10-21-14, 202 dated 8-20-14, 224 dated 10-20-14, 233 dated 5-30-14, 236 dated 5-30-14, 237 dated 5-30-14, 238 dated 5-6-14, 239 dated 5-5-14, 240 dated 5-5-14, 241 dated 5-5-14, 242 dated 5-5-14, 243 dated 5-6-14, 244 dated 5-5-14, 245 dated 5-7-14, 246 dated 5-7-14, 266 dated 5-5-14, 267 dated 5-5-14, 271 dated 5-6-14, 308 dated 6-17-14, 337 dated 6-18-14, 338 dated 6-5-14, 340 dated 6-4-14, 371 dated 10-17-14, 372 dated 10-15-14, 373 dated 12-3-14, 378 dated 10-16-14, 550 dated 9-8-14, 551 dated 8-5-14, 553 dated 9-23-14, 555 dated 8-27-14, 561 dated 12-3-14, 563 dated 8-25-14, 710 dated 7-10-14, 7, that's interesting, 724 dated 9-2-14, 727 dated 7-22-14, 1028 dated 8-27-14, 877 dated 9-26-14, 926 dated 12-2-14, 1045 dated 11-13-14.
1054.
Huh?
I have 1054, not 1045.
You're right. I stand corrected, or sit as it were. 1217 dated 10-27-14, 1233 dated 10-21-14, 1247 dated 11-25-14, 1254 dated 12-9-14, 1270 dated 9-16-14, 1339 dated 10-15-14, 1345 dated 9-23-14, 1588 dated 11-12-14, 1613 dated 11-6-14.
On the date on 1588.
Oh, 11-21. Okay.
We're getting there.
Okay, I just did 1613, right?
Correct.
Yep.
I got that in, okay. 1777 dated 10-10-14, 1878 dated 11-20-14, 1880 dated 10-20-14, 1882 dated 12-9-14, 2047 dated 12-2-14, 2049 dated 11-25-14, 2050 dated 10-24-14, 2059 dated 12-1-14, 2060 dated 11-21-14, 2062 dated 12-1-14, 2063 dated 10-31-14, 2064 dated 12-1-14, 2074 dated 11-30-14, 2076 dated 10-27-14, 2078 dated 10-15-14, 2080 dated 10-10-14, 2168 dated 11-10-14, 2553 dated 10-21-14, 2556 dated 10-20-14, 2564 dated 10-16-14, 2717 dated 10-22-14.
All right, thank you, Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz moves for the introduction of the LCs as committee measures that have just been read. We're also going to incorporate the list that we have in front of us, this yellow sheet, as part of the record as to what has been introduced as part of that motion. So any objection, any discussion first regarding the motion? Any discussion, no discussion, any objection to the motion? Not seeing or hearing any, so moved. And we'll go ahead and close the work session of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee that was open for the purposes of an introduction of the LCs for this coming judiciary legislative session. With that, thank you very much. We're now going to go into our informational hearings, and I apologize that we are getting a little bit later start than we anticipated, but as I said, we wanted to make certain all of the members had an opportunity to take the votes that are necessary to ensure that those bills would be able to be pre-session filed. So with that, we're going to start. These are informational hearings. The first one will be Protecting Oregonians in the Age of Big Data. And I got Nate Cardozo and the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum. And Attorney General, is there anyone else besides Nate that you would like? Please have them come up.
I think just Mr. Cardozo at this time.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Cardozo, thank you very much for coming. I understand that you had to travel to get here. We appreciate you coming to Oregon.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm quite honored.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. First, I want to thank you for giving all of us here today the opportunity to be part of your family in airing your affections for your departing members. And I just wanted to add our appreciation, the Department of Justice, for the wonderful relationship that we've had both with Representative Tomei and with Representative Hicks. And we will miss both of you very much. Thank you for your service. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I am the Oregon Attorney General, and seated with me is Nate Cardozo, who is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in California. I'll give you a little more of his bio at the conclusion of my remarks, and then we'll move into Mr. Cardozo's. Thank you for giving us some time on your very busy Ledge Day calendar. My purpose in being here this afternoon is to help you understand why the Department of Justice is so concerned about big data, both its near miraculous uses as well as its real potential for abuse. I want to start my presentation by way of an anecdote that demonstrates what I'm talking about, at least with regard to the miraculous side. In 2009, scientists discovered a new virus. Combining the elements of multiple flus, this new pathogen, known as H1N1, caused immediate alarm, not just among those infected, but also among epidemiologists concerned that H1N1 could represent a new superflu. As you will recall, this new virus was extremely contagious and had the potential for massive infection and significant loss of life. Some commentators warned of an outbreak on the scale of the 1918 Spanish flu, which infected 500 million people and killed tens of millions. It was a scary prospect, and many Americans wondered how they could prepare. In the first day of any or days of any new outbreak, much of the attention naturally goes to figuring out how fast an illness is spreading. In the United States, the front line for tracking the spread of an infection is the Center of Disease Control, the CDC, which tracks the spread of an infection mostly by relying on a system of self-reporting. If you go to the doctor with flu-like symptoms, this information will eventually make it back to the CDC. Of course, there are several factors beyond the simple fact of an infection at work here. For example, in order to report and be counted, a person has to actually go to the doctor, has to live in an area where healthcare is available, and have the resources to access that healthcare. Most of the time, a person turns up at the doctor days after they became sick, and worse yet, already contagious. On the other side of the country, another organization also carefully monitored the spread of H1N1, Google. The Google search engine receives over 3 billion hits per day and archives them all, giving them a treasure trove of data far beyond what any federal agency could ever hope to gather. Google examined what people had searched for during previous flu outbreaks and looked for correlations between the frequency of searches related to flu-like symptoms and the actual known spread of flu. It worked, and far more quickly. Their software found a combination of 45 search terms, which when used together showed a strong correlation between their prediction and the official numbers. Applied to H1N1, the results were startling. The CDC, a bedrock of epidemiological research in the United States, working at top speed and full alert, was not nearly as accurate in its predictions of the spread of flu as Google, a company working without any epidemiological experts, medical scientists, or special medical expertise. Google had only one thing, data. Where did this data come from? Us, the power of consumer information. Each of us is responsible for the generation of a tremendous amount of data. Every search you make, saved. Every Facebook post you write, saved. Every link you click, every Amazon.com purchase you look at but decide not to make, every song you play on iTunes, is in some way retained and categorized. And once you give over this information, this voluntary gift of data can never be taken back. Some of it is bundled with millions of other people. Some of it is only used to track you. but all of it is stored, retained, and analyzed somewhere in the data sphere. And make no mistake, the millions of dollars spent to gather this body of information is not a coincidence. It is an investment. Your data, the songs you listen to, the places you drive, the articles you read, the gifts you buy, who you buy them for, these are not simply numbers. These things have value, enough to make up a $16 billion and growing industry called big data. The emergence of this new industry prompts hard questions. Because it is fueled by a tremendous appetite for data, much of which is generated unconsciously or semi-consciously by consumers, it's natural and important to raise concerns for individual privacy and the protection of consumers. And because this data has so much value, it is inevitable that sooner or later someone will come around and try to steal it. While this type of theft can take many forms, the most epidemic is what we commonly refer to as data breach. Stealing financial information can lead to quick, easy money for thieves. USA Today estimates that a staggering 43% of companies have experienced a data breach in the last year. While many of these breaches are small, the Target breach of 2013 is believed to have impacted the personal information of 40 million Americans and 800,000 Oregonians. In fact, it's overwhelmingly likely that some of you in this room have been the victim of a data breach. Like 47 other states, Oregon has legal protections against data breach because of our 2007 law, the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. This statute was modern in 2007, but the world keeps moving. In 2007, your thumbprint wasn't used for much unless you worked at the Pentagon. In 2014, many of us use our thumbprint to unlock our smartphones. It's no longer simply our social security numbers or financial accounts that are things worth stealing. As technology changes, so must the legal infrastructure which protects that technology. Among the most important questions for any legislature is how best to keep pace with the dead sprint of technological progress. It's for all of these reasons that I am committed to bringing legislation forward in the 2015 session designed to take a close and careful look at the adequacy of the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. I hope we can explore not just the adequacy of our legal regulatory framework, but of the very way that we think of what we mean by the terms personal information. 10 years ago, stealing your identity was about getting hold of your bank account or your social security number. Now, criminals are just as likely to target your medical information or your insurance data or your social media presence. All of these are inroads into you and the valuable data that you create and that all of us must work to protect. But on some levels, dealing with data breach is the easier question. We live in an era where even our televisions have settings which govern how your TV can track where, when, and for how long you're watching TV. It's the same with our cars. And this is an area that Mr. Cardoza has a lot of expertise in. They can record where we drive, what music we listen to, of course, and who we call on the way where we're going. All of these are governed by so-called privacy policies, which are often long, legally dense documents. Have you ever tried reading one of them? Soon we will wear smartwatches and smart glasses along with our smartphones and smart cars, and all of these will be smart precisely because they have the ability to understand, process and retain data, to interface with other devices, and to broadcast that information into the cloud, another word with a brand new meaning. And so I view the larger question as this: what is our role as legislators, as regulators, as agency and community leaders with regard to all of this data? None of us want to kill the figurative goose laying the golden egg. High-tech companies have been a job creator and driver of economic growth in Oregon, well beyond the Willamette Valley. At the same time, Oregonians should expect to be protected from fraudulent, misleading, and unfair business practices, no less online than they are in their home communities. Oregonians want to and should know how their online information is being used and to whom it is being sold. There is massive potential in this data for new inventions, new innovations, new jobs, but also for new forms of abuse and exploitation. So it is time to consider where Oregon fits into this new world. And because this is such a complicated subject, I've brought along some help. So just briefly, Mr. Cardoza is a recognized and published expert on free speech, privacy litigation, and the protection of privacy in the digital age. He has projects involving automotive privacy, speech in the schools, government transparency, hardware hacking rights, anonymous speech, public records litigation, and resisting the expansion of the surveillance state. Earlier this year, I hosted my first internet privacy symposium. Some of you were able to attend. We brought together regulators, social media networks, advocates, and academics in a critical discussion of internet privacy and how to best protect consumers. Nate joined me then for this day-long symposium and provided the audience with an important voice on a topic that can be complex and troubling. So at this time, I will turn to Mr. Cardoza to add to these remarks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Krieger, thank you very much, members of the committee and the Attorney General. My name is Nate Cardozo. I'm a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco, California. And as the Attorney General mentioned, I do free speech and privacy litigation as well as policy actions around the country and around the globe. I'm honored to be here, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions at any time or at the end of my presentation. As the Attorney General mentioned, the amount of data, personal information about ourselves that we give to third parties simply as a function of living in the modern world is staggering. The devices that we keep on us and around us at all times leak like sieves. And for the most part, it happens completely behind the scenes, without our knowledge, and certainly without our consent. And it happens because the systems that we use were purposely designed to collect that data and to share it with others, and to do so in a completely transparent manner, in a way that you never know is happening. Take your car, for example. If you've bought a new car in the last 2 or 3 years, chances are excellent that your car knows more about you than even your closest friends. Most new cars contain not only a GPS and an event data recorder, the so-called black box that monitors driving behavior, but a cellular data modem to relay the information it collects back to the manufacturer and possibly to others. On some level, automakers might argue that drivers should be expected to know that that's happening. If you use an in-dash GPS-enabled device to search for directions, you might expect that that information goes to a server at some point. But the actual scope of the collection is staggering. And it's not just maps either. Other in-car services collect even more. Searches for businesses. If you use the system to dictate text messages or emails, those are being stored too. If you have your home address stored, that gets shared with the manufacturer as well. What does this mean in practice? The nice part is that the car can email you when it's time for an oil change or when your tires are out of alignment. And it can let you know when there's more traffic on your usual commute and suggest a better way of getting home. But it also means that Ford, just to use an example car maker that whose privacy policy I've studied, can algorithmically identify where you live, where you work, who your doctor is, where your kids go to preschool, where you worship, where you spent Monday afternoon, and where you'll likely spend tonight. Ford's terms and conditions state that Ford will share your location, share your driving habits, share your search history, share your directory lookups, share your sports news and weather favorites with third parties in order to present you with a more personalized experience. I'm a lawyer, and I can say with a straight face that a more personalized experience can mean just about anything. It could mean presenting you with better ads, selling you better car insurance, giving you coupons to the stores that your car knows you like to go, or maybe their competitors. It's essentially no limitation. And it's all buried in a set of terms and conditions way back on Ford's website that I sometimes have trouble finding. But even setting aside how Ford intends to share that information, the very fact that it's collected by Ford means that Ford can be compelled to turn it over. Data detailing your most private habits to anyone armed with legal process. Any civil litigant now has access to your daily habits. Law enforcement can reach back in time and track suspects with potentially less legal process than it would be required to do if they were to install a GPS tracker by themselves. An intelligence agency with a mass surveillance order could force Ford to turn over the whereabouts of all Ford drivers. So could a hacker who had only marginally better skills than the people Ford pays to protect that data, or rather the people that Ford's subcontractor pays to protect that data. And that brings us to the crux of the problem. it's nearly impossible to figure out where your data is, who you're giving it to, and where it's going, or how it's being used. And it's often impossible to exercise any control over that flow of information. As the Attorney General said, we should have a right to know where our data is, where it's going, and who it's being sold to. But there is currently no statutory right in any state, to my knowledge, certainly not in Oregon. In a May 2014 report, the Federal Trade Commission recommends that Congress require that the data broker industry be more transparent and give consumers greater control. Data brokers are simply not transparent. Consumers do not know who is obtaining their data and where it's going. And consumers have very little control over the problem. One positive step that I'll mention just briefly, Axicom is a large data broker, the nation's largest actually, and who the Attorney General invited to the symposium that she mentioned earlier. They now offer the users, their customers, or their people whose data they collect, the ability to correct personal data collected about them through a website they launched late last year. But Axicom is one of the better players in this industry, and this situation is not the norm. Usually, you can't even correct incorrect data about you. Among Oregonians, some of the least prepared to do an inquiry into what they're trading in exchange for their personal information are K-12 students. Schools increasingly contract with third parties to take advantage of online data storage, productivity software, or cloud computing services. Some services, such as ClassDojo, are explicitly designed to track student behavior over time. When we went to school, our permanent records were stored in a filing cabinet in the administration's office. Not so anymore. They're stored in the cloud, whatever that means. These services may greatly reduce school costs and may increase the quality of student education, especially in poorer districts where students may not have access to technology at home. But they offer increased risks for student privacy if student data is not carefully handled. To use another example, Google, whose lovely free pen I have with me, gives free or reduced cost laptops known as Chromebooks to schools around the country. Schools use a school-branded version of Gmail and Google apps for free as part of the educational experience. But Google is extraordinarily cagey about what information they collect from students and how they use it. Google states that they don't use student information to target ads to those students. But that's just about all they say. They appear to be collecting student data in the school context and combining it with data collected outside the school while students are logged on to their student account using not school services, other Google services. Google is completely opaque with what happens to the data collected outside the school context when combined with data collected in the school context. And after graduation, we really have no idea what happens to that data. We at the Electronic Frontier Foundation have been trying for months to get a straight answer out of Google, and so far we have failed. Existing federal legislation that traditionally has protected student privacy, like the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, also known as FERPA, is unclear how to treat digital records. FERPA was passed in 1974 and did not envision things like the Chromebook or ClassDojo. New state laws, however, could provide meaningful privacy protection in the online world. In California, this session we passed SOPIPA, a statute that will go into effect in January of 2016. SOPIPA will place several restrictions on companies that offer online sites and mobile apps targeted primarily to K-12 school purposes. So PIPA will ban targeted advertising and prevent the development of student profiles. This is precisely the question that Google is unwilling to answer, or appears to be unwilling to answer, to at least the EFF. So PIPA will also prevent the sale of student information and the disclosure of personally identifiable information about students. With services already gearing up to comply with SOPIPA in California, now is an excellent time for Oregon to address the same issue. and student privacy and school privacy in general. So PIPA would also require educational services to maintain reasonable security standards rather than, and it uses the term reasonable, and I think that's important because rather than try to specify individual or specific security standards that would surely be outdated even before the statute went into effect, it gives an industry standard reasonable security practice level. And most importantly, unlike FERPA, which only created liability for the school, so PIPA would create liability directly for the service provider that misuses the information. And this is critical. Under the current scheme, if Google creates profiles of students and then targets ads at them, that would be a FERPA violation. But it would be the school that would be on the hook for that violation, and Google would get off scot-free. And that does not exactly create an atmosphere where districts are incentivized to apply rigorous oversight to their service providers, especially rural districts that don't have particularly much in-house technical expertise. And while SOPIPA does not create a private right of action, it would allow enforcement against the service provider by public agencies as well as the Attorney General's office. And that brings me to my final point. While there is definitely a need for additional statutory protections and transparency, Oregon can use its existing powers to protect its consumers. As the Attorney General said, Oregonians should not have to give up their rights just by virtue of participating in this modern world. We don't expect our cars to be telling advertisers which doctors we see. We don't expect our students' school-provided email to be creating a permanent record of their behavior that can be monetized at a later date. Fraudulent, unfair, and misleading conduct online, as the Attorney General said, is just as fraudulent, just as unfair, and just as misleading as that same conduct offline. And we deserve to know what our technology providers, the providers that we depend on for our modern everyday lives, know about us and who they're telling about it. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you. First of all, I had a request, Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, if you could provide us with a copy of your testimony, if it's available electronically. One of the members
Absolutely.
Asked. Okay.
Yes, we certainly can, and I can ask my staff to arrange for that immediately.
Okay. And then, Mr. Cardozo, a lot of the presentation you gave, you did use acronyms. And do you have a list of the acronyms with what they actually stand for?
I could create something for you, Mr. Chair.
That would be wonderful for our staff. We'll be able to know, and we'll have that as part of the record. That would be great. Thank you. Questions? Representative Tolman?
I really don't have a question, but I'd like to make a statement, if I may.
You may.
Thank you very much. Before we let our good Attorney General go, I just want to commend her. We've heard hearings in both our committees about child sex trafficking, and so we passed some really good laws. But what we didn't have was a program for the underage child victims of sex trafficking. And because of the good Attorney General's help and her staff help, good Aaron here, who had been also committee person in this committee several years ago, we've been able to come up with a program that's going to be opening by the end of this month for children who have been victims of sex trafficking. Not only that, but the good Attorney General has allowed her staff to set up a board so that the programs that will be set up for these traffickers, the children who are trafficked throughout the state, a board will be set up to facilitate these. So we have much to thank her for and her office. They already are busy enough, we know that. But they were able to take this on, not just having us pass bills, but to follow up with what needed to be done. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the comment. Questions, Senator Rubin?
Yeah, just a comment. When she required her to send the deal, she became part of the big data.
Right, we've stopped using email, Mr. Chair.
All right, I don't see any other questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
And because we're a little bit behind on time, I need to just do you want to do this one up now or do you want to go and do this one? All right, so we're going to go with our next panel on protecting privacy and reducing victimization. Chief Spaulding, Sheriff Roberts, and Ryan Lufkin, who is a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County, if you all three would come up. So, gentlemen, as y'all are getting settled, thank you very much for being here. Again, we apologize for the time delay. For whoever's going to start off, and for each of you, if you could make sure you identify yourself for the record, that'd be appreciated. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Vice Chair Krueger, and special thanks to Carolyn Tomei before she leaves just for her amazing commitment to our county, and just want to say thank you very much for your service. I'm here today along with law enforcement fellows from Public Safety, Chief Jeff Spaulding, the City of Beaverton, Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney, Ryan Lufkin, and we're here today to testify as participants in a law enforcement responsible technology work group, it's also known as LERT, to talk about the use of technology as an effective law enforcement tool and the balance of that use while protecting privacy.
And Sheriff Roberts, if you could just put your name on the record as well.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I apologize. I'm Craig Roberts, Sheriff of Clackamas County.
Thank you,
sir. Now, toward that end, we'll address the use of license plate reader technology. Chief Spaulding will discuss professional policy in Oregon and discuss the use of body cameras. And Deputy DA Lufkin will address electronic communication and privacy in the context of modern Oregon statute. Excuse me. So I'd like to begin by turning over to Chief Spaulding.
Oh, thank you, Sheriff. Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Jeff Spaulding, Police Chief from the City of Beaverton. So in order just to provide a little context before we talk about a couple of the technologies here, I'd like to let you know that we do things a little bit different in Oregon, in a good way. And we take our profession and our reputation very seriously. We've really worked hard to ensure that there are appropriate checks and balances, and I'd like to share some of those with you. So to start off, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Police Academy. Most of you are very familiar with the Department of Public Standards, Safety, and Training, DPSST. This is one academy, the only academy in the state that provides the basic training for all of our law enforcement, corrections, and other professions in the state. This is a professional academy that, by having one academy in the state, it integrates the best practices in this training academy and provides a very high level of consistency. The other thing that this the DPSST is responsible for is the certification and decertification of the certified officers, correction officers, and parole and probation in the state. The DPSST provides a very rigorous decertification process that removes law enforcement officers from their profession if they've committed a crime or they violated a moral fitness standard. On the average, there are close to 100 of these individuals that are decertified on a yearly basis. I know it sounds like a lot, and it is, but we're talking about 1% out of the 10,000 that we have in the state. As a result, Oregon enjoys an excellent reputation for building a police culture with high ethical standards and high levels of accountability. The other important thing I'd like to mention is the accreditation process in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Accreditation Alliance is an entity that was created in partnership with the sheriffs, the chiefs, and telecommunicators in Oregon to enhance the professionalism in the state. This is done through the development of core best practice standards that are implemented in agencies and are validated through a rigorous evaluation process and are reevaluated approximately every 3 years. Also, I'd like to mention the Oregon Center for Policing Excellence. This is a relatively new program that was created at DPSST designed to make policing in Oregon more efficient and effective through research partnerships with Oregon academic institutions. And one of the things that you're probably already aware of is we do have an unprecedented collaboration between the city, county, and state law enforcement. This is not universal where competition over turf and funding are often present in other states. We like to believe that we take a very strong, proactive approach to aggressively addressing areas of concern. We have a reputation for aggressively addressing issues of concern related to policing practices and policy. Oregon policing profession evaluates tactics and practices on a regular basis and makes adjustments in practice and policies when identified. And one recent example is the formation of the Eyewitness Identification Subcommittee or Work Group. This came about as a result from some concerns from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and others. This concern caused us to convene an eyewitness ID group, as I mentioned earlier, that examined research, and we drafted an adaptable policy framework and worked with agencies throughout the state to update policies and best practices. We then worked with the Police Academy to create training resources that were distributed to law enforcement agencies throughout the state.
In May, we will sponsor a special training event with a newly formed Oregon Innocence Project that features Jennifer Thompson, who wrote the book Picking Cotton, which is about Ron Cotton, who was unlawfully incarcerated for many years because of a bad witness identification. The eyewitness identification is just one example. There have been several others over the past years in working with missing persons, missing vulnerable adults, veterans in crisis, bias-based policing, and more. So at this point, I'm going to turn it back to Sheriff Robertson, and I'll come back after he's done with the camera piece.
So now I'd like to talk to you about LERT, the work group. Again, it's the Law Enforcement Technology Work Group. And so LERT was formed and first met March of 2014. This was a self-initiated work group of law enforcement, prosecution practitioners who have on-the-ground expertise in issues related to the use of electronic communication, technology, and surveillance. The work group includes police chiefs, prosecutors, and members of Department of Justice as well. So now LERT is dedicated to developing some statewide best practices and policies related to the use of technology to fight crime and also balance the privacy issue that we've heard about today. And also to make recommendations for the legislature to ensure that law enforcement is able to deploy new technologies in a manner that meets the dual concerns of citizens' privacy and also crime protection. So now I'd like to talk briefly about the automated license plate reader, also known as ALPR. Law enforcement knows how significant license plate readers have been as a resource to identify vehicles that have been involved in crimes. We also understand the use of technology raises concern amongst personal privacy, access, and misuse. So there's many misunderstandings about ALPR technology and how it works. And some citizens believe that we're able to know where each and every vehicle is during any given time, and it could be misused to track their activities. So I'm hoping I can clarify a few of these issues to just clear up any misunderstandings about the use of ALPR and the technology and how we access it. The technology, to describe it, uses an infrared camera to take a picture of a license plate on the front or rear of a vehicle. Some believe that the picture also includes a driver, which it does not. It only includes the license plate itself. So the plate is then compared to what's called a hot list of plates associated with criminal activity. License plate readers only capture the numbers and letters on the license plate and the location of the plate. There's no name or personal information attached to any of the data collected. In order to obtain personal information to identify the registered owner associated with the license plate data needs to be run through the Oregon Law Enforcement Data System or other law enforcement databases that it has that personal identifying information, such as LEDS data, which we check, which has legitimate law enforcement purposes and is strictly controlled and monitored by the Oregon State Police. One of the key policy considerations related to ALPR technology is the length of time the data is retained and as an investigative resource. Well, the state policy around the United States on this issue is varies widely. We believe that a 2-year retention period allows law enforcement the time necessary to use the license plate data to solve crimes. In closing, I just want to assure you that the protection of personal privacy is a public safety priority for all of us, and it's also a concern to make sure that we're balancing our ability to keep our communities safe. So now I'm going to turn it back over to Chief Spaulding, who's going to talk a little bit about body cameras.
Thank you again, Chair. I'm sorry we're bouncing around a little bit.
All right.
Body-worn camera technology, no doubt you've heard about this in the media as of late, and it has become a hot topic, not just in the media, but obviously in our law enforcement circles. And we actually are very encouraged by this technology and think in time that this is going to be a very promising tool that we'll be able to use in law enforcement. And I suspect somewhere down the road this will become a common practice in many law enforcement agencies throughout the country. But the one thing that we want to ensure that people understand is body-worn cameras are not the panacea, and that we need to educate the public as to their limitations. Body-worn cameras do not record perceptions. They do not correctly record the depth of field. They do not take the physiological dynamics into consideration or identify factors in play outside the field of view of the camera. Cameras will never replace a thorough investigation. It's also important for agencies to select camera systems that closely match the visual acuity of the officer at the scene. Technology is capable of image enhancement capabilities that could provide a viewpoint that doesn't reflect what the officer is actually seeing. And examples would include infrared technology or changing the frame rate, accelerator frame rate, etc. We believe legislation is necessary to provide an exemption from the audio recording notice requirements when a police officer is utilizing a body-worn camera. There may be times when it's next to impossible or impractical to do so. We also believe that there should be a restriction on the public disclosure of recordings of officer interactions and require police agencies to establish policies and procedures for the use, storage, and retention of body-worn cameras if they plan to deploy the technology. And just in closing on my piece before I turn it over to Mr. Lufkin here, we do believe strongly that Oregon law enforcement must uphold our responsibility to protect both the public and protect their privacy rights of citizens in the performance of the policing function. We strongly believe this is not an either-or proposition and both can peacefully coexist. We do believe that agencies should adopt well-vetted best practice policies and employ necessary training before deploying a policing technology. We believe that policies vary from one agency to the next based on a wide variety of factors, including agency size, geographic location, etc. We also believe that agencies should align their strategies from agency to agency to the greatest degree possible. We believe that legislation should provide a framework for authorizing the use of policing technologies and establish policy guidelines. However, we believe legislation should avoid adopting prescriptive agency policy and statute because of the need for the policy flexibility to allow agencies to quickly adopt policies as a best practice evolves. And we'd like to believe that our proven track record will support that we have the ability to police ourselves and working in collaboration with many of our partners throughout the state. So with that being said, I would like to turn over to Mr. Lufkin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Lufkin. I'm a Deputy District Attorney with Multnomah County. In that capacity, I've worked pretty intimately and on the front edge of how digital technology and law enforcement interact. I often provide training to the Portland Police Bureau and to other members of my office on how to appropriately and legally obtain this type of digital technology. I hope my comments today will provide a kind of an overview on what the law currently permits and does not permit and how it interacts with law enforcement to do its daily routine even today without any current legislation. So as an outset, both the U.S. and Oregon Supreme Court have consistently recognized that a law enforcement intrusion into the affairs of an individual must be assessed on whether, one, the individual has a recognized or commonly understood expectation of privacy in the space that's being intruded, two, the significance of the law enforcement interest in conducting the intrusion, and three, what due process was afforded the individual to guard against governmental overreach. This is generally understood to assess the reasonableness of a governmental action. With that framework in mind, I'm going to walk you through the continuum of what is currently available to law enforcement to access certain pieces of information. At one end of the continuum, we have information that an individual places out into the public space. As applied to technology, think a message that's been publicly posted on Facebook. In run-of-the-mill cases, think statements that a suspect may have made to their friends or neighbors admitting to the crime. There is no reasonable expectation of privacy in these types of scenarios, and no court has required that law enforcement engage in any kind of burdensome process to obtain easily publicly accessible information. Additionally, any member of the public without law enforcement tools could obtain that kind of information, and thus law enforcement is in no particularly special position when compared to members of the public. As you move across the continuum from public space, you'll see that the amount of process that burdens the police increases. Generally, when the police want to seize an ordinary business record that's held by a company, law enforcement will coordinate to issue a subpoena. compelling the production of those records. While a subpoena is not ordinarily available to every member of the public, it is certainly available to all members of the bar and civil practitioners. As the Oregon Supreme Court has noted when assessing third-party records, records that are just generally held by businesses, the individual does not typically have a significant constitutional interest in keeping that type of material private, and thus a subpoena is the recognized tool to obtain it. A smaller subset of that class of information has been held by legislatures, both federally and state, to be especially private. You can think of health information, juvenile records, certain types of criminal records, food assistant records, DHS records. The list goes on. These are specially set records that the legislature has deemed to be private and require increased process before law enforcement can obtain them. For these types of records, the legislature typically spells out exactly what the burden is that the law enforcement must reach before obtaining them and what process is in place to secure them. In the criminal context, most of these records are produced with a subpoena to the grand jury. Some require protective orders that prohibit the disclosure to anyone else once they've been obtained by the grand jury, and a few require a court order which is signed by a judge. Before moving forward, it's worthwhile to note that documents that are subpoenaed to a grand jury require them to be presented typically by the lead investigator who testifies under oath to the citizens that are representing the grand jury before the grand jury actually approves the production of those records. Those grand jurors are told what the investigation is and why the records are important, and are freely able to ask any questions of the investigator before approving or disapproving the production of the records. Finally, at the top end of the scale are search warrants. Search warrants are reserved for areas where the privacy expectation for the general public are at its height. They have historically been implemented where the police are intruding upon the home of an individual, the content of the individual's communications, and include some additional enhanced procedural protections when police are acting undercover or are surreptitiously intercepting communications, like in a wiretap. These types of intrusions, monitoring or intercepting speech, intruding into the privacy of the home, are the types of intrusions that bear the greatest risk to individual liberty and thus are protected with our highest burden. After reviewing this progression, it's natural to think, well, a search warrant sounds great. We should have that for even more things. As someone who practices in criminal law, I could tell you about the huge negative practical consequences for taking that line of thought and applying it to even more things. That would include talking about the subpoenas that would turn from regular subpoenas into search warrants and how burdensome that would be on all practitioners. But what I want to focus on is a more nuanced point. And to me, it's a more important point. If you dilute the significance of what it is to obtain a search warrant by applying it to ever more categories of items, you're diluting what that protection was originally intended to guard against: intrusions into the home and into our free speech. When you do that, it is going to be inevitable that you are going to be lowering the standard that is applied by all members of the bench and the bar when applying search warrants. The axiom that comes to mind to me is if you try to protect everything, you end up protecting nothing. And that's because necessity is simply going to overcome how difficult it is to obtain search warrants in all cases. It's not going to be by any bad faith, but over time, it's going to become, the standard is going to be lowered in order to just get this work done. So, after much discussion about these exact issues, we've come to some ideas and conclusions about what we think are an appropriate framework that properly balances the privacy rights of Oregonians with the legitimate needs of law enforcement. Cell phone records in particular come in different flavors. Law enforcement could be seeking only to know the identity of the purchaser of the phone and the billing information of that phone. For this type of intrusion, we believe it is indistinguishable from seizing ordinary business records, and therefore a subpoena should be required. For records that disclose where someone was in the past, not ongoing tracking of someone in the future, which we agree requires a warrant, we believe that investigators should swear out an affidavit and produce a court order signed by a judge before obtaining that kind of information. We believe, consistently with what is current federal law, that the appropriate standard before releasing that kind of information is reasonable suspicion. Finally, for personal communications and data, a search warrant proving probable cause should be required. From that framework, we also want to bolster and refine what some of the current existing statutes protect to update it for modern technology. We want to increase the due process that's required to further ensure that there's increased transparency when police officers are engaging in this conduct. This includes filing subpoenas with the court, which is not done currently, and specific criteria laid out in statute that must be met by police officers before a judge would sign a court order. What I want to conclude by saying is, I think, a comment that's been echoed by my colleagues. Both privacy and effective law enforcement are important to me and all Oregonians. I hope that we can work together to balance those interests in a way that works for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we take questions, I do want to put on the record, this is a 30,000 to 50,000 foot overview. I expect that we will see everyone that's at this dais again for another round in the process of the bills moving forward. But I will entertain a few questions. I don't want to go too deep just because we have such short time to make up all for the other presentations. So any questions that need to be asked and answered right now? Not seeing any. You're fine. You're okay with this? All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's good. It worked. I can only do that once, and that was by the one to do it on. Okay, we're going to change our agenda just a little bit because we have a speaker in the next panel we're calling up, which will be on the report from Task Force on Juvenile Court Dependency Proceedings. And I understand, Honorable Sullivan, you have a plane that you will need to catch. So please come up, and Megan Schwartz and Nancy Kozine. And we'll come back to the third presentation, which is on House Bill 3194, after this one. And as we said with the last panel, whoever's going to be speaking, if you'll please identify yourself for the records, we would appreciate that. And y'all can go in whatever order you would like to proceed with.
I'm Judge Sullivan, and to get home, I have to fly to Boise, Idaho, so I really appreciate it. And it seems like every time I come here in the winter, I bring terrible weather with me. And this is Megan Schultz from the CASA program and Nancy Kozang from the what is your official title?
Executive Director from the Office of Public Defense Services.
We're here to present the final report of the Joint Interim Task Force on Juvenile Court Dependency Proceedings. We're going to be very brief because we're hoping to be back later to talk about what is hopefully getting a bill number, but right now is known as... What are we calling this? LC
2058.
Right. I'm going to turn it over to Megan to tell you a little bit about, and very quickly, what caused the task force to be formed. And then we'll turn it over to Nancy to talk about this.
Chair Przanski and Vice Chair Krieger and members of the committee, thank you for hearing this information about House Bill 3363. My name is Megan Schultz. I'm the Executive Director of CASA of Lane County and the President of the Oregon CASA Network. Back in 2012,
Can I get you to move the mic away from you? Yeah, it's very, okay. Very sensitive. Thank you.
Okay. Back in 2012, we made a tour of the state, we meaning the Oregon CASA Network, talking to our 1,800 CASA volunteers that are on the ground working these cases in juvenile dependency court, to find out what was working and what was not working from their point of view on the ground. And we came up with a lot of things that were working and a lot of things that were frustrating and not working. And when we came back from that tour with all the information, some of those things were things that could be addressed on the local level between the program and their Department of Human Services or their court. Some of that stuff was things that the Oregon CASA Network could be talking with the other stakeholder groups and resolve those issues that way. But there was a lot of other things, or several other things, that we believed could only be addressed through a change of statute. And that became House Bill 3363, and it literally was a potpourri of many different issues that we were trying to resolve all in one bill. And through that legislative session in 2013, with many, many conversations with former Judge Michael Livingston and Legislative Counsel Bill Taylor, we came to an agreement that really what was happening was that the statutes were okay, that they were clear, they were written in a way that would that they were intended to be. But what was happening is on the ground, the stakeholders, including CASA, were causing things to, were doing things that would cause delays in the system. So all of us are here because we all have a different role, but we all have the same goal, and that's to get children out of the system as quickly and as safely as possible. And so this work group pulled together all the stakeholders to look at, can we identify what the delays are from the moment a child enters the system until their court case is closed and hopefully their home have found permanency? What are the delays? And what is the action or inaction that someone, a stakeholder, is taking that is causing that delay? And what can we do to resolve that delay? So this work group spent a lot of time identifying the delays and talking about what we could do as individual stakeholders to address those delays. And so some of the report you'll see, and Judge Sullivan will talk about, what commitments we ended up making and what recommendations we have coming out of that work.
Thank you.
The report does focus on impediments to timely permanency, and we you'll see the report is divided up into areas that we thought were specifically very significant, and we were also charged with looking at with what we could do within the context of the present system without spending money to improve things. So we tried to focus on that also. We also wanted to provide information about current initiatives that are in place that are working on these problems. And then you'll see the end of the report and Appendix 1 are commitments by each of the individual stakeholders in three areas: process improvement, oversight and standards, and education and training to improve the process, and with the goal of achieving timely permanency for children who are in foster care. Now, one thing that became very apparent when we started is that an overriding and number one concern was quality legal representation in juvenile court proceedings. And that includes representation of all parties to the proceeding, including the state, and in particular, what we're going to talk about now is parents and children. And as part of that, we heard a presentation from the Washington State Parent Representation Program, and in the middle of our process, Nancy's organization started a pilot program in Lynn and Yamhill counties that we have followed very closely. And the final thing that we want to talk to you about today is our legislative concept. Basically, we felt so strongly about this that we wanted to join the Oregon Public Defender Services in their effort to expand the pilot program, because we think that this is a critical issue in achieving permanency for children, in providing competent and full representation of parent and children, and providing adequate system resources so that the system can reach optimal goals in the most timely manner. So let me turn this over to Nancy to talk a little bit about the LC.
All right. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, thank you again for having us today. Nancy Cosine, Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services. And you have a one-page handout that tries to summarize the various efforts that went into the final LC 2058. We had the representatives from the Washington State's Parent Representation Program come and present to our committee and also to the Judiciary Committee earlier this year. Their success has been documented many times. It's been studied. We've heard about it. We were lucky enough to get funding from the legislature in the last legislative cycle,
to launch our own pilot program. It launched in August of this year in two counties. We have Lynn and Yamhill counties. These were counties where we did not have full representation for our clients, and we can now report that we do have full representation and that we're already receiving very good feedback about the program and about representation of children and parents. LC2058 expands upon that concept and would allow full representation for parents and children, also representation of the Department of Human Services. It would also include funding for full court resources. One of the things that we discovered during our work group discussions was that many times court hearings are set over either because the attorneys aren't available, the court doesn't have docket time, or because the agency doesn't have legal representation and a critical issue has arisen in the case. So by creating the model dependency system, we can actually measure outcomes as a result of full representation for all parties. And we are available for your questions.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, just a comment. During our earlier meeting, we were talking about it maybe being a Senate bill. It will be a House bill, and it was pre-session filed earlier. Or it will be pre-session filed. So
right.
Just so you'll know where to look.
Thank you. Any other comments? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Safe Travels.
Thank you very much for moving me out.
You bet. So that's going to close that presentation. Our next presentation is going to be on House Bill 3194 and the Department of Corrections Transitional Leave Policies. We have Michael Schmidt and Jeremiah Stromberg. Gentlemen, thank you very much. You know the routine, and we appreciate you all being here.
Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Krieger, thank you for having us, members of the Judiciary Committee. It's good to be in front of you again. So we'll keep this brief. You have in front of you a handout. Hopefully it's coming around right now. And on the front page is a graph entitled Prison Population and Forecasts. So I'll wait for that to come around. The good news of this presentation is that we're here to update this committee on House Bill 3194, and it's a story of success so far. And what you have in front of you is what the various prison population forecasts were projected to be under different scenarios. The green line that you see at the very top is what the prison population was forecasted to be had 3194 not passed. So what we have on the very bottom line, 3194 enrolled bill estimate, is what we thought would happen when 3194 did pass and what the Department of Corrections was funded at. And what you can see is from the black line that cuts in between those two lines is the legislative changes to sentencing and the investments made into counties, along with the program set up with the Department of Corrections, have largely kept us below that red dotted line and then the bold red line into the foreseeable future. And what that means practically is that this legislative session, we're not in front of you talking about Deer Ridge opening the other half of its facility or talking about breaking ground on Junction City. You can see that the orange line is where the prison population is projected to go, taking into account how these changes in statutory law have taken effect. On the next page, this breaks down in these two bar graphs both the overall prison intakes in the state, and you can see that across the board, comparing post-3194 to prior to 3194, we're down by 172 prison intakes. And then specifically looking at the five different crimes that House Bill 3194 targeted, identity theft, driving while suspended, robbery in the third degree, marijuana, and all other drug crimes, you can see that we've had some of the intended effects, maybe not fully what we were estimating we would have, but that we did have some of the intended effects, and those are due in large part to the success that we're seeing so far. The other biggest factor is what Jeremiah Stromberg, to my right here, is here to talk about today, which is the work the Department of Corrections has been doing on short-term transleave.
Good afternoon, Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Krieger, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections. You should have received a second handout that has a series of charts and graphs, and they are coming around now.
I'm going to provide you five statistics around the short-term transitional leave program, which under House Bill 3194 was expanded from a 30-day program to a 90-day program within the Department of Corrections. Between the collaboration of not only the department, but certainly with the counties, the community corrections agencies, the sheriffs, we have created a very successful program within the first year, of which I want to highlight a few facts for you. As you can see from the first chart, women make up 9% of the prison population, and yet within the trans leave program, they make up 18% of the population that we've been able to release early. This is based not only on their statutory eligibility, but the fact that we also consider behavior in the institution, as well as compliance with any and all programming that we require. And so we have seen, since December of 2013, 1,032 inmates go out early on the trans leave program from anywhere from 30 to 90 days early for their leave. On the second page, you can see the breakdown of crime type as it relates to those going out on trans leave. And approximately one-third are property offenders, one-third statutory, and one-third person-to-person offenses. Again, all of these are non-mandatory minimum sentenced inmates who are eligible to go out on the program. On the third page, and this is where certainly we've been most pleased, of the 1,032 inmates that have gone out, 997 have been successful during their time as inmates in the community. Only 35 have returned to us since last December. And of those 35, only 5 of them returned having committed a new violation, a new law offense. And so the others that were returned were based on continual technical violations, if you will, and non-compliance that we recognized they needed to come back to finish their time. We have created a great system, again, with our county partners to ensure that they have the resources, certainly through the Justice Reinvestment Funding, to adequately supervise this population and sanction them appropriately in the community without returning them to the most expensive beds that we have available in our prisons. So we're very pleased with the success that we've seen with this. Within the Department of Corrections, we review every violation that our inmates commit in the community and then work with our community partners to determine the appropriate response and whether they should return to us. For those that have stayed in the community, turning to your fourth chart, you'll see that 852 have not even been sanctioned or had to be disciplined while in the community. Only 50 of the inmates have received a local jail sanction where they had to serve some time in the local jail due to the severity of a violation. It didn't warrant returning to DOC, but it certainly warranted a response from our parole and probation officers. So this has been also very exciting to look at, to see that we're seeing a high level of success. The average inmate who did serve a sanction served 11 days in the local jail and then returned back to the community for supervision under the Community Corrections Agency. The primary violation that we've seen is continued substance abuse. So we recognize the need to continue to work with our inmate population and while they're on supervision to ensure adequate treatment resources are available for them. And on the last page, one of the biggest concerns for the counties was that they would become responsible for housing the DOC population within their local jails. But as I just explained, we've only seen 50 of those 1,032 enter jail. And you can see here that that has meant 633 jail bed days have been used in the last year, compared to the 35,030 prison bed days we have now saved by implementing this program. So we have been highly successful. We are going to continue to track their success beyond trans leave. We want to look to see how they do on supervision overall, and once they've completed supervision, we want to compare the population within our prison who didn't behave well and didn't program, and then were ultimately released 90 days after these folks, and how they do long-term to really see what the cost-benefit analysis and overall success of this program is. And with that, I'll certainly answer any questions you have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just wrap up by saying that what we've shown you today on these different charts and graphs is the sentencing changes at work and how those have prevented the increase in the prison population. What we haven't been able to really quantify up to this point is the work that's being done in the counties, investing in programs to increase their capability to supervise offenders and get better results. So we continue to look forward to that justice reinvestment funding that has already been invested in the communities, but we anticipate that we'll see continued results beyond just the statutory changes from that investment.
Thank you. Comments, questions? I have one, and that's, Jeremiah, on this number of the 1,032 that have been released on your second slide that shows approximately a third across. Could you break out for us, if you don't have it now, get it to us as to what their risk assessments were, as to where they were low risk for reoffending, or in the sense of whatever the DOC is using, so we can just kind of understand if there is a mix of different risk offenders that are captured in this, or if you know that already?
Chair Przanski, I can certainly get that data for you. I will tell you that it ranges from low risk to high risk.
Okay.
Again, even some of our high-risk inmates have participated in treatment and been compliant and have not received disciplinary action, resulting in their eligibility for the program. But I can certainly get you a more detailed breakdown.
I think that's great because it's one of the things that we want to continue to address as to who are we allowing to have these releases. And if we can actually show the data that it can be across the board, then I think I might make it a little bit more comfortable for people to maybe see next steps as to other ways to take some of the load off the prisons and still have safety within our communities.
Absolutely.
All right. Any other comments? Thank you all very much, gentlemen. We're going to go ahead and jump to our next one. And Representative Bowles, you have your choice of staying here or going down.
I'll go ahead and go on.
Okay.
Here.
And then joining her will be Kathy McInnes and Ashley Buckle. And this is going to be a presentation on advancing technologies and invasion of privacy. Good afternoon, and whoever would like to go first, just please remember to identify yourself for the record.
All right, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Denise Bowles. I'm the state representative from House District 19. Really want to thank you and thank Chair Barker for seeing this important enough to squeeze it into the agenda today. LC 2051 was drafted really due to the courage of Kathy McInnes and her daughter Ashley, who are here today and wanting to change their community and their state. Ashley will share more of her story, but this past fall, Ashley's stepfather was convicted for burglary, stalking, and an invasion of privacy in both Marion and Benton counties. There were seven victims in this case. Some of them are here with us today, but in the interest of time, we're going to keep this to the three. He left a hidden camera in the bathrooms and bedrooms of these women, stored their images on a USB drive. He is spending nearly 4 years in prison now. He was convicted just about a month ago. But it's not because he was secretly videotaping these women, but because of three counts of burglary that he was charged with. Currently in Oregon, invasion of privacy is a misdemeanor. It doesn't matter your age. It doesn't matter the circumstances. In this past month alone, there were several other cases reported on being investigated in our state, one in Albany, involving the owner of a drain cleaning business who allegedly secretly videoed at least three women in various stages of undress. Another case a few weeks ago is taking place in Happy Valley that involves a man who was considered a dad figure in his community. Many high school kids were in and out of that home, many of them. Turns out that he had hid cameras in his own home, the bathroom and bedroom that were used to videotape the girls as they were invited to house sit while his family was traveling. This has become really personal. I have two daughters and a son. And and walking through this with these ladies and talking with other victims, it has been surprising to me to find that there is really not a adequate punishment for this incredibly personal and invasion of these people in a place that they should expect to have privacy. Under current law, an invasion of privacy is committed if a person knowingly makes, records a photograph, motion picture, videotape, or other visual recordings of another person in a state of nudity without the consent of the person being recorded, and the victim has a reasonable expectation of personal privacy at the time of the visual recording is made, or for the purposes of sexual gratification. A person observes another person in a state of nudity without consent, and the victim has a reasonable expectation of personal privacy. Again, this is a misdemeanor in our state. And so I'm introducing LC 2051 to make the invasion of privacy a Class C felony if the person has a previous conviction of some specifically defined crimes, the individual has multiple offenses, or the victim is a minor. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce Ashley to share her story.
Chair Prozinski and the members of the committee, please accept the following statement as my support for the LC Draft 2051. My name is Ashley Buckle. I live in Kaiser, Oregon, and I was victimized by my stepfather, Brian Tilley. Below is a statement I read at his sentencing, and I would like to submit it as my testimony. Thank you. Though it is nearly impossible to put in words the pain and fear I experienced while being stalked by Brian, not to mention the ongoing list of crimes he committed, here is a brief description. During my senior year of college, I was stalked over the internet, not knowing who my stalker was. My Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, email, cell phone, and computer were all compromised and were used by my stalker to post threatening and unwanted pictures and statements without my consent. Once we found out that my stepfather was the stalker, we discovered several hidden cameras in my home in Corvallis, Kaiser, and other victims' homes as well. These hidden cameras were placed in bedrooms and bathrooms without victims knowing. Additionally, this is what I read to my stepfather at his sentencing. When I heard I had the opportunity to tell you how I feel, I didn't know where to start. You have caused so much pain in my life over the past 14 months, and there's no way I could explain all the pain and suffering you've caused me. I confided in you, and you convinced me your intentions were to help me protect me and identify my stalker. You checked in on me daily to make sure I was doing well and helped me file police reports. You made me feel safe, protected, and reassured. When the person I found out who stalked me was arrested, instead of relief, I learned that the last 15 years of my life was a lie. The man I called my father was solely responsible for terrorizing me. You witnessed me fear for my safety, yet you continued to stalk and harass me. Not only did you stalk and harass me through my social media, you also tracked me in my every move on my GPS on my cell phone. You continually controlled my life by threatening me and punishing me with embarrassing pictures on my social media. You gained complete power by shutting off my phone numerous times so I could not get in contact with anyone and blocked many of my friends. You instilled fear in my best friends, my family, and my community. You would blame me every time something went wrong and would tell me I was tearing this family apart. You were so good at lying and never thought you would get caught. I was afraid to open up my front door every morning to start my day. I should have never had to feel that way. No one should be afraid to leave their house worrying about something might happen to them. You destroyed so many of my friendships and tried to convince me everyone was an awful person. Not only did you stalk me, but you placed hidden cameras in my bedroom and bathroom, in my Kaiser house, and in my apartment in Corvallis. The fact that you think you have the right to watch me in my bedroom and bathroom proves what kind of person you truly are. No father should want to watch their daughter shower or get undressed. Not only did you think you had the right to my privacy, but you also filmed other women. You have no right to watch other people in their bedrooms and bathrooms. You have caused me, my family, my friends, and my community pain, but I'm the one who gets to walk free today. I have such an amazing support system, and because of this, I'm stronger. I am now in the process of trying to change laws so people like you can't victimize others without a serious punishment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you guys today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Kathy, were you going to be sharing some comments
yes.
to us? Okay.
Sorry, I'm just taking
all right.
a deep breath
you take
here.
Your time.
To start with, I just want to thank the committee and
thank Chair Bresky for allowing us to testify and share our passion today with you. I am Ashley Buckle's mother. For your record, my name is Kathy McGinnis, and I reside at 890 Cater Court, Kaiser, Oregon. Today, I'm here to represent my family, my friends, and my community. Today's laws have not kept up with today's technology. Do any of you have a wife, a daughter, a granddaughter? Well, let me share with you how that can impact their lives. Currently in the state of Oregon, the law allows someone to enter your home and place a camera in your own bedroom and bathroom. Retrieve that camera and view it. This is only a misdemeanor. Invasion of personal privacy is only a misdemeanor under the current law in the state of Oregon. This also includes minors. Also, the perpetrator does not have to register as a sex offender. Once these videos or pictures have been taken of these victims, they are out in the world forever. We are not sure of where they might be shipped or who has access to them. We would like to see that Oregon laws be changed to invasion of personal privacy from a misdemeanor to a felony, and that they would have to register as a sex offender. Denise has shared examples with you of other in our state, and I have done research of many others in other states. I would just like to thank you for allowing us to share our story with you today, and I look forward to meeting with each and every one of you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? I'd like to put something on the record. Just Ashley, first of all, thank you very much for being willing to come before us and tell us this very personal story, and Kathy the same. We have had similar legislation that was before us this last cycle that's still being kind of worked on. One of the issues that we've found ourselves with is proportionality of how individuals, based on the type of crimes and the type of sentencing they get. That's one of the complexities that we're going to be continuing working on. But your testimony has been heard by everyone here. We're going to do what we can to try to accommodate and justify what would be reasonable, with the understanding that we have to also maintain the integrity of our system so we don't have it called into question through a court action. But we will be looking forward to having you participate, if you'd like, during this 2015 session.
Representative?
Ms. Buckle, is that the name you used?
Yeah.
I just want to thank you as the mother of a 7th grader and a 10th grader. I want to thank you for your testimony and your courage and your leadership.
Thank you.
It takes a lot of guts, and what you're doing makes a huge amount of difference, and we will take to heart what you said and the support that this community is bringing today to help make sure that nothing like this happens without adequate punishment, and in fact that things like this don't happen in the future. It's not right, but what you did just now is really right, and thank you.
Thank you.
May I just introduce to you to other young women that have a lot of courage and that are willing to step out and share? Melissa, would you stand? And Kelsey, would you stand? These are my daughter's best friends. They also were a part of this crime, and they are willing to stand up, and I believe they have their testimonies also.
Well, thank you all very much for being here. As I said, we'll see this on the agenda. It's been introduced, and we have one that the Senate was working on. We had a similar situation, unfortunately, out of Springfield that got a lot of, community outrage as to the situation, but we'll be working on that. And again, thank you all very much. And for the two, thank you very much for being here as victims yourself, but also as supporters for the others. All right, we're going to close that presentation. Our next presentation is going to be on the report from the Department of Aviation on drones. Mitch, why don't you come on up?
Vice Chair Krieger. My name is Mitch Schwecker. I'm the Director of the Department of Aviation, and I'm here to report to you on the requirement of House Bill 2710 to report out on the status of federal regulation and a recommendation to you on whether we should register private use drones. First thing, we also have to register by January 2nd, 2016, all the public use unmanned aerial systems. And I'll talk a little bit at the end about methodology, database, rulemaking. And then we also have to do some coordination with some of the agencies that have expressed an interest in using them. And that's ODOT, Department of Forestry, Agriculture, Fish and Wildlife, and public universities. So the video here I'm not going to show is a kind of example of the technology that's available with unmanned aerial systems or drones. And I won't show it just in the interest of time, but there's a heck of a lot of valuable uses, and some of them are listed right here, in ag and forestry, fish and wildlife, fire suppression or fire notifications, and then emergency management, search and rescue, damage assessments and identification. If you saw recently the Napa earthquake, there was an amateur drone that took some video of the damage done in the city there that shows you kind of an example of what it's done. That was all done illegally, but it shows you an example of what could be done. And then ODOT has expressed some interest using LIDAR to look at damage from bridges and that sort of thing in the event of a seismic event. So much of this is generated, the status of federal regulations, through the FAA Modernization Reform Act of 2012. That imposed about 19 specific acts that the FAA was supposed to do to introduce drones into the national airspace. And to cut to the chase in the interest of time, they're not going to make their deadlines. They're supposed to introduce them by September of 2015, and there's an IG report by Department of Transportation that says that they're not going to make that. They also directed 6 test sites around the country. Oregon submitted, but they submitted with Alaska. And so Alaska was a shoe-in to get it, so it was a very beneficial thing that they did. And Alaska and Hawaii are part of the, I'm sorry, Oregon and Hawaii are part of the Alaska contingent. And the other ones are listed right there. And then because I know there's a tremendous amount of interest in the privacy policy, the FAA issued a privacy statement in September of 2013, which essentially said that that's not their job, work in privacy, but they did direct that the 6 test sites have a privacy policy and that other federal agencies do the same thing, that they actually keep data on how they use them, when they use them, and that they have a privacy policy of their own. So the three test sites in Oregon, Tillamook, Warm Springs, and Pendleton, and they're in the process of implementation right now. And each one of them offers some great geographic diversity and some opportunities that are desirable to the companies that want to operate them. This chart right here, which I won't go through each one of them, but it basically gives you the timelines that were not met by the FAA in those tasks that were part of the Modernization Reform Act of 2012. The ones I will hit on are the two bottom ones that are in red. Within 18 months, they're supposed to have a small UAS policy to introduce them into the national airspace system. That was supposed to happen in November 2014 at the latest, was the last that I heard. This is the middle of December. They still have not introduced it yet. And then the IG report, as I mentioned before, they won't make their goal of introducing unmanned aerial vehicles into the National Airspace System by September 2015. So the FAA is very restrictive about how they use them. Privacy, due process, and the risk of collision, the safety issue, I think, are one of the primary things, or three of the primary things that have slowed them down. And then the other thing is they have control of all airspace per FAA guidance. So there may be some issues that that we have to look at later when we talk about the altitude restrictions and where people can and cannot fly. Other things in the federal arena, they're soliciting a center of excellence that comes with substantial grant money. There is at least one university here in the state that's applied to be a part of that. One of the things that the universities have been hamstrung by just a little bit is they have done research, and I'll use precision agriculture as an example, where they have used a drone to do precision agriculture research, and the FAA came out with a legal determination that that was not authorized, that they could only do research on drones themselves, not to use them as a vehicle for other types of research. They backed off of that a little bit, but it's kind of hamstrung universities and their ability to work with private corporations. And then the other thing that's happened is, because of the slow pace of federal regulation, there's a group, Akin Gump, that's been hired by some fairly high-profile people, Google, Amazon, and they're going to both Congress and the FAA asking for an acceleration of the slow pace of their regulation. And I suspect that they may be successful in their efforts. There is one way to get a commercial capability to operate a drone. Right now, that's a 333 exception that's named after the section of the Modernization and Reform Act that it comes from. And they've only allowed six so far until this morning. And I handed out a press release earlier today that I don't know if you have or not. But they issued another five or six today, one of them to an Oregon company, VDOS, and that just happened this morning. So in all of the ability to operate drones in the U.S., the recreational community operates them freely. The commercial, not at all, unless they have a 333 exemption, and then there are some 500 and something public use authorizations allowed. So in addition to the legislative piece, there's also some litigation pieces that the FAA has been concerned with. And if you look at the YouTube video here, I believe you have this electronically, and I'm not going to show it again in the interest of time, but about a minute and 30 into the video, a operator was flying a drone at the University of Virginia and flew under overpasses and kind of in a careless and reckless manner. And my opinion, it was careless and reckless. And FAA saw it, fined him $10,000. The the guy who flew the drone appealed or contested the fine, and it was upheld. They vacated the fine, NTSB administrative law judge. And so it kind of hamstrung the FAA's ability to enforce regulations regarding drones in the recreational community. That was reversed just in the past month, November 17th. Another administrative law judge for NTSB said, yes, the FAA did have the authority to regulate that. So combining that with something that you see down there, a clarification at the bottom, a 19-page notice of proposed rulemaking, they now are back in the enforcement mode for recreational and commercial or anybody else that operates a drone. There was another case, Texas EquiSearch. They contested their ability to fly via an email, of all things. And it's not been resolved yet, but they're back operating right now, too, because they were told that FAA didn't have the authority to enforce. All of the recreational use is based on a one-page advisory circular from the FAA from 1981. AC 9157, it still governs, although it's going to be superseded here in the near future. And it basically says in two phrases that you can't fly above 400 feet, and you have to stay clear of airports and clear of crowds. That's essentially the sum and substance of that regulation. The other thing that Congress directed the FAA to do is not to regulate the recreational community. That's also true of House Bill 2710. It specifically says not applicable to the recreational community. However, the FAA did issue the clarification, the 19 pages, and what they did say, which was an enhancement or a change to that one-page regulation, is that you can't use what's called first-person view, meaning the viewpoint of the actual aircraft, the drone itself. You can't use that as a means of controlling the aircraft line of sight from the operator. And then they also reaffirmed their intent via the rulemaking process to start enforcing safety regulations via that NPRM. So we have a little bit of an issue airspace-wise. You have this AC that's been in effect since 1981 that says no flights above 400 feet. We have House Bill 2710 that says no flights below 400 feet over private property or you're subject to civil penalty. And then there's also a number of court cases. And in fact, just this month, there's a report out that I'll make sure that you all have access to called Drones and Aerial Surveillance Considerations for Legislators. And it talks about all the legalities of airspace and cites a number of cases and where it's been upheld that it's okay without a warrant to overfly people's property. But this is an area that we'll have to look at. And one of the things is, how do we balance that out? Is it an altitude restriction? I can be at 410 feet. I could fly such that you could look on somebody's property. You can be adjacent and not over the property. It's very difficult to determine whether somebody's at 400 or 300, or if you don't have some sort of a regulatory way to look at it. And then Nassau is working with the FAA on the process of identifying airspace for the unmanned aerial vehicles. And they're looking primarily, from what I'm told, at altitudes below 500 feet. And they're also looking at some technological changes, and that's a sense and avoid, what would be, if you're in a manned aircraft, see and avoid, which is a doctrine that you always want to do. You don't want to fly into anybody. So they're looking at automatic sense and avoid, so that an aircraft using what they call the ADS-B technology, automatic dependent surveillance and broadcast, it basically gives you relative position data from an aircraft, whether it's manned or unmanned. And if you had that ability, you'd be able to determine where another aircraft is and be able to avoid it. And then there's some other technological changes they're working on too. If you lost a communication link or a GPS signal autonomously, they can fly to a designated position or something like that. And then FAA has allowed some integration into unregulated airspace up in the Arctic. That's the only place so far. And the 333 exceptions that I mentioned earlier, there are some 167 of them, not 90 of them now. And who's flying them right now? There's about 545 active certificates of authorization to fly. And if you look, the lion's share of them are going to universities, a surprisingly few to the military, and then federal agencies, law enforcement, and local governments. So this is a list of the state, what 2710 does. It protects privacy. It has some law enforcement provisions. It is the only state, Oregon is the only state, that has a preemption clause. And in the report that I submitted to you, Appendix D has a list of all the regulation in all 50 of the states, so that you can take a look at it and determine where Oregon stands and whether you like to do additional legislation. And then talked about the civil penalties, and we plan to register the public use ones by January 2016. I'll have a recommendation for you in just a moment here to talk about the private use ones. And then we've worked closely with ACLU, some law enforcement folks, and trying to balance out some of their interest as well. And one of the ones that I'll share with you is ACLU is concerned about state agencies sharing UAS imagery with other agencies or other entities. So that's something that we may look at, or the legislature may want to look at. And then there is already a cottage industry in the state. They're operating right now. I've seen them, heard them. I was in Memphis, Tennessee not too long ago, and there was one flying down the middle of Beale Street in the middle of the day. They are sophisticated. They're stabilized gyro HD cameras. You can buy them in the Verizon store. You can buy them at Fred Meyer's. And we've seen, or I've seen, an increased number, and if you watch the news recently, an increased number of incidents with manned aircraft, you know, on short final commercial aircraft to and from airports. So that's an area that I have an interest as the aviation director. And I also have some challenges. If we're going to register the recreational ones with manned aircraft, an airport is like the beehive. With these folks, where they buy them on the internet, they can build them in their garage. They don't need an airport to fly them. It's going to be a little bit like chasing bees instead of going to the beehive to catch up with them. Should we register private use drones? That's the question tasked by 2710. And there's really three classes. There's the public use ones, which we will register. There's the private use commercial, and then private use recreational. Recreational, pretty much unregulated right now, although I mentioned that the FAA is going to crack down on them. And then there's weight classes, 55 pounds and over, 55 pounds and under. That plays into how we might register them. There are some organizations, and I think you have testimony from one of them, that says that they'd like to see an exemption for very small ones that are under a pound or 2 pounds or so. So I offered three options to you. And one is that we register now all three classes. The other is register only the public and commercial and leave the recreational alone. That was in House Bill 2710 and federal regulation, but maybe there's a need to. And the third is that we register all three categories, but that we wait and until we have a little bit more fidelity on what the federal regulations and litigation are doing. So I recommend that option, and here's why. You're still going to get to the identification and accountability, but there's so much change and transition in federal regulation and litigation. There's virtually no commercial operations allowed right now except those 333 exceptions. So I think that if we wait, we can set up the process and see how the federal and the litigation shakes out and be better prepared by also having maybe a working group to look at the whole process and who should and who shouldn't, what the altitude should be. And so that's really my recommendation to you, is that we wait. We should register them. I think there needs to be accountability, and most of the industry agrees with that. They want to be protected as well when they're legitimate operators. And so subject to any questions, that's my testimony.
Thank you. Questions? Questions. Representative Williamson.
Thank you. And thank you, Mitch, for you and your department putting together this report. I know it was a big task, and you did a great job of reaching out to interested parties and, you know, having forums and being out in the public to get feedback on proposals and information. So I appreciate all the work that you've done on this. I think you identified the issues that we're facing. How do we build how do we grow a cottage industry? How do we use UAVs to both save us money to get into places that we can't get into now? It's cost prohibitive, whether it's agricultural research, universities, law enforcement. We have access to places that we wouldn't have access to, and I think that's an important balancing. And the economic benefit in the commercial side of being able to use UAVs to advance businesses. So all of those things we need to keep in the background. I agree with your recommendation around registration of commercial, private commercial, that putting that off for the FAA makes a lot of sense. Even though the FAA hasn't met a single deadline, there are reviews of them in this space have been abysmal, that they can't be trusted, that they're not working through this process well, that it's problematic. And they've gotten plenty of feedback on how this has been working, and it hasn't been going well. So I guess I'm okay with waiting for the FAA on the commercial side if we can trust them to move this process along. I'm most concerned with the private recreational and how we manage that and how quickly we can get our arms around a business that is selling 10,000 units a month in the U.S. So these things are flying off the shelves of Fred Meyer's. At least they are in my neighborhood. They're selling like hotcakes. And how we get our arms around knowing who has them and where they're flying them is my biggest concern. And I wonder if anyone has looked at taking the registration out of the aviation world and putting it somewhere else. For example, treating UAVs like cars, whether it's licensing, registration, training for individuals in a system that already exists and that we're familiar with. Has any state looked at that kind of regulatory process?
Chair Przanski, Representative Williamson, only North Carolina, of all the other 49 states, has a registration requirement. Mm-hmm. And they do it through their Department of Transportation.
Yeah.
I think we already register manned aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
We register some 4,000 plus mm-hmm. per year. And mm-hmm. on the next slide, I have a notional
right.
way we might look at it. I think there's an opportunity here to do that. We actually, working with committee counsel, we put together two placeholders. I don't know if they're still valid.
Mm-hmm.
Both one in the House, one in the Senate. To enable legislation if that's the direction that you'd like to go.
Well, I encourage us to think about the categories separately and not lump them all together because they're the same type of vehicle. But it makes a lot of sense if we're looking at public and private commercial to compare it to a model of small aircraft. But if we've got individual citizens flying these things in cities and towns without any training and without any way to track who's flying what vehicle, that makes me very concerned very quickly, and treating it like a car or another vehicle that we already have a system that makes a lot of sense, I think, is something we need to be looking at.
Chair Przanski, Representative Williamson, there is a community-based organization, the Academy for Model Aeronautics, that they've submitted testimony that they are very concerned about this as well. They are the recreational and in some cases commercial advocates for the industry themselves. They're taking this on as a project themselves, so there's some relief there, but I don't think they'll catch everybody. It'll take some work with law enforcement to try to figure out how to enforce the safety piece of this.
Right.
Yeah. We're such a small agency, can't be everywhere. So I look forward to a working group that we can address this issue.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So what we're going to do, we have three more presentations to do, and we had 15 minutes for each of those. I'm going to ask the presenters on the next three if you can keep your comments concise, and maybe we'll be able to get everyone out on time. So our third to the last is report on School Safety Task Force. Sheriff Roberts, you're back, and Superintendent Evans. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
So, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, again, good afternoon. I'm Sheriff Craig Roberts, and I'll try and expedite my testimony here to get you back on track. So I'm testifying as current chair of the Task Force on School Safety, formed by House Bill 4087 in 2014. I'm here together with Task Force Co-Chair, Superintendent of State of Police, Rich Evans, to provide you a report on our progress as well. So just to refresh your memory real quickly, House Bill 4087 set forth five objectives to be determined by the task force: develop a request for a proposal for a database for schools, floor plans, make recommendations for administrative rules regarding the use of the database, examine education and training models for school safety and incident response for first responders and school employees, examine models for standard response protocols for school safety, and determine whether to recommend standardization for statewide school safety and incident response protocols. Real quickly, in July 2014, the membership of the task force was formed with appointments of the following 14 individuals. Rich Evans with the State Police, Director of DPSST, Eric Gablix, Governor's Public Safety Advisor, Heidi Moad, Governor's Education Advisor, Daniel Ledma, Senator Betsy Johnson, Representative Jeff Barker, I'm representing OSSA, Chief Spaulding's representing the Chiefs of Police. We have somebody from Oregon Education Association, Reed Scott, who is a teacher. Oregon School Employees Association, Susan Graves. Safety coordinator, she's a safety coordinator with Lincoln County School District. We also have Oregon School Board Association, Peggy Halstead, director. Oregon Association of Ed Service District, Dave Novotny, Superintendent of Willamette ESD. Also the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, Matt Utterback, Superintendent. It's, as you can see, a very broad group on that committee. On August 4th, 2014, we held our first meeting. We met again a few weeks later, August 28th, and again on October 27th and November 17th, with a total of four meetings. Our next meeting is scheduled for January 13th. We'll say over the past 4 months, in a short period of time, we've had meetings that there have been 11 shootings, incidents at schools across the United States, to include 9 deaths and 8 injuries. And that does not include the tragic shooting at Reynolds High School. So the need for unified statewide school safety measures has reached a critical level, and the task force has really been working diligently to develop our recommendations. Toward that end, over the past 4 months, the task force has engaged in a variety of presentations. Just to give you an idea of the folks that we're having present to us, we had the FBI present on active shooter and some national data. We also examined two different standard response protocols for school safety. One is called I Love You Guys Foundation, and another one is the Readiness and Emergency Management for Schools, which is REMS. We had presentations from a database program and mapping. We've listened to a presentation of Lines for Life. It's a youth tip line that provides teen-to-teen youth crisis support. It's also a text line as well for youth. And at our next meeting in January, our plan is to focus on the timeline for our recommendations, examine threat assessment programs, and continue our work towards determining the necessary requirements for a statewide database for school floor plans. So on that subject, I'm going to turn it over to Oregon State Police Superintendent Rich Evans, and he kind of covers
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rich Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the state police. So we have been, as the House bill rolled out, we have been tasked with the technology side. We completed a business case for the data for the floor plan database. We have a signed agreement between education and the Oregon State Police for a request for information so that we can see what is out there and follow the new stage gate process for IT projects within DAS. That is projected to take about 6 months. Once that 6 months is hit, all the information is collected, we will bring it back to the task force. We then will come back to the legislature and talk about the move to the RFP, the request for production process, with all the recommendations from the task force for you. The second thing that we heard a lot about is the tip line. And in our research, we found out that there is a ORS 180650 enabled in 2001 under Senate Bill 3647 that allowed the Department of Justice to set up a tip line for schools to report illegal, suspicious, and questionable activity. The key to that, as I read that law, the key to that is subject to availability of funds. And in March 24th of 2006, that was discontinued by the Department of Justice. When we heard from Lines of Life and some of our research from the folks that testified, about 80% or more folks that do attack schools tell somebody else about it, and we do not have a statewide system for reporting that. We also heard from Lines from Life, and they are getting tons of calls from schools, also from teens, about suicide and about school bullying. which often leads to some of these events. So we're looking at it as a broad-based task force. We're going to start looking at the tip line maybe for an all-hazard, all statewide issue, so that there is a resource for that law enforcement, schools, everybody knows that this tip line's available, and we're going to work through the details of that as we come back. But we found that that would be an extremely helpful benefit for the tip line and the database, and then not only focus on just school shootings, but school safety in general. This, you know, with children, the bullying issue really caught me by surprise that that was their number one call for the Lions for Life, and that it was affecting, they had some stats available on how many school days were missed due to bullying, and if we're investing in our children, that's extremely important. And I think we can cover that for the task force. So quickly, I'll go back to Craig.
Thanks, Rich. And just in addition to the requirements for the database and floor plans, one of the big issues is we've spent a considerable amount of time on statewide standardization of school response protocols. And I can just tell you personally from talking with superintendents within our county and schools, there is a wide variety of plans and levels of preparedness. And even among schools, as I said, within our own county, as we've looked forward, as the task force has looked forward on this across the state, we see that very same thing happen across the state. So of equal importance that we've talked about is language that all Oregon schools and first responders can use during these events at schools. And there's just, I can't tell you the litany of different descriptions of from red, yellow, blue to 1, 2, 3 to lockdown, lockout. And for teachers and staff and students that change schools and to have some just fundamental standard practices that we can all learn over time. Stop, drag, and roll. We all know what that is, and the same kind of concept is something that within a school we can do that very same thing. So what we had to do on that is formed a subcommittee, which was just a terminology work group to identify all the terms, look throughout the state, kind of see what everybody's doing, and see if we can jointly find some common ground on that. So I think just in closing, I have to say we feel very honored to be a part of this task force. We really are working hard, diligently, to collectively work together with education and all the players at the table, and I feel like we are making a lot of headway. So with that, I'm trying to speed it up to get done soon, so if there's anything else, I'm done.
Any questions for anyone?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate what the superintendent is doing with this. I mean, this is huge.
So yeah, it's very huge.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
So I understand there's a reverse order for the last two. The report on Lane County Sobering Pilot Project is going to go next.
Mr. Chair, if we're going to combine us, we'll get you out of here early.
Okay, no, that's fine. That'd be great.
So we're going to do a combination of the two.
And y'all have your speakers.
That's the plan. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. PowerPoint. Yeah. So, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, and we'll make this real quick. And I'm not sure which button I push.
A good one.
Just right arrow. Oh, just push right. Okay, right arrow. Okay, so we're just here to report back to you. Really, we held a series of public safety summits around the state of Oregon to gather information about what we can do to help, in particular, our distressed Oregon counties provide basic public safety services. And there were three common themes that resulted from those series of public safety summits. These are the three I've listed here. There were additional ones, but these are the primary three. And so I'll talk briefly about number two and three, and I'll make it snappy. But I'm going to turn it over to Cheryl to talk about number one right now, and then we'll go from there.
Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I am Cheryl Ramirez, Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. Oregon, like all other states in the nation, has a disproportionate number of individuals with mental illness in its jails. I've included, as a matter of fact, just a recent announcement from National Association of Counties and the Council of State Governments on an initiative they're beginning across the nation called Stepping Up. I've included that in your packet to just show that this is a problem everywhere in the nation. The Association of Oregon Counties, in conjunction with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, other mental health, public safety, and criminal justice partners, has initiated a legislative concept we are calling Criminal Justice Behavioral Health Partnerships. This legislative concept seeks to establish and strengthen cross-system partnerships and coordination among mental health, criminal justice, and public safety systems to assist those individuals with mental health and substance use disorders. We're also asking to invest resources in community-based alternatives to incarceration. This would include from the basic prevention of criminal justice involvement in the first place. So that's an example of that would be effective mental health and addictions treatment in the community to keep people in the community. To really a focus on crisis services array so that if an individual does come into contact with a law enforcement officer, that officer has some choices rather than taking that person to jail or the emergency department. There may be crisis stabilization centers, for example. There may be other responses to take with that individual with the assistance and support of their mental health system partners. So, kind of in general, it's really linking an individual to the right services at the right level in the community when at all possible. So with that, I'd really like to turn it over to Mark, who will talk about one of the services, a sobering station in the service array that we're suggesting as a community-based alternative.
Mark. Senator Prozaski, Representative Krieger, members of the panel. My name is Mark Douthat. I'm the director of Buckley Services, the sobering station there in Eugene. And we received a special allocation to fund a pilot project there as an alternative to law enforcement trying to handle some of the individuals that were in increasing numbers that were starting to become what was termed high utilizers of services in the emergency rooms and by the police and other crisis services in the community, oftentimes highly intoxicated. What we provide is a residential setting that they can be brought in to, highly intoxicated, waiting for that moment of clarity, and we have a case manager on duty there that can then utilize some motivational interviewing to engage that individual, and then we have a vast array of services, some of which that we have on site right then. Most of them we were able to leverage in our detox program, which is adjacent in the same building. And so with this in mind, what we've been able to do is serve through the end of October 138 individuals that had been part of a revolving door, if you will, with an 82% reduction in repeat admissions through the sobering station during that time through the end of October. As a snapshot of these individuals that we're treating, these high utilizers, we traded a list of names with the City of Eugene's Police Department of 24 individuals that were responsible for 485 contacts with the police departments. And they asked us to compare these to our records to see if these were the same people. What we found was that 22 of them were the same people. So we're absolutely targeting the population of people that are overutilizing the emergency rooms and the hospitals and the police agencies throughout the Eugene-Springfield area. This could be anywhere in Oregon. And the success that we've had to this point, we've been able to provide residential, long-term residential inpatient referrals, outpatient referrals, all manner of mental health, medical. We have an integrated continuum of care at Willamette Family that we're able to bring to bear and leverage for these people to be able to make sure that they're successful in their travel through our system and back into the community.
So back to me. Okay. So the other two pieces, and I'll just be real brief here, that came out of our summits is district attorney services. And I assume you all have this handy-dandy thing we like to hand out like candy. If any of you don't have it, I'll be in your office tomorrow and I'll drop one off. But DA services is traditionally a shared service, shared in the sense that it's funded by both the state and the county. And traditionally, historically, the state paid for four items, district attorney salaries, a portion of deputy district attorney salaries, witness fees, because these are all cases prosecuted on behalf of the state, as well as the DAS assessment, the mandatory DAS assessment. just to let you know, in 1975, the state paid for just under 20% of the total cost of DA services statewide. The bulk of the rest was borne by the county, with some being paid for by federal grants, et cetera. By 2000, however, over that 25 years, that 19% had shrunk to 9% through various budget cuts. And so in 1997, the legislature directed the Attorney General to study the ramifications of that bleed out, or however you want to call it. Hardy Myers issued a very lengthy report, thoroughly investigated, and he detailed the harm to public safety that had occurred as a direct result of this. He detailed the shift of financial burden from the state to the county that occurred as a result of this, and he recommended in $1999 that the state enhance the DA a budget by $20 million to essentially restore a balance of shared services between the state and the county. Unfortunately, by 2003, 4 years later, the state didn't do that. They just eliminated two of the line items for the DAs. They got rid of all supplement for deputy district attorneys, as well as the entirety of the witness fee line items. So actually things got quite worse, and that's how it's remained ever since. In 2009, Governor's Task Force, which I believe then Representative Roblin served on, issued a report talking about counties in financial distress for a variety of reasons, and their recommendation number 7, much like Attorney General Hardy Myers a decade earlier, said the state needs to really restore support for DA services. The Efficiency Task Force prioritized the recommendations from the Governor's Task Force, and they prioritized this very high at number 3. And that was chaired by Representative Nathanson, as you can see. So our proposal here, as part 2 of our package, is to restore some of that support from the state and to return to some semblance of balance. And we think we have a very modest request. We're not even asking for $20 million in 1999 dollars scrolled forward to today. We're asking for half of that. What would that do? It would restore the witness fee line item budget. So the state is again paying the small witness fees that are paid to witnesses that appear in actions brought on behalf of the state. It would do part 2 of the salary increases that you covered for the DA's last session, as well as the bulk of it, as you can see, would go to restore some state support for deputy district attorneys. This will bring you a very small percentage of support, but it's significant. And so that's part 2 of our public safety package. And then the final one I'll just mention briefly is the 911 tax, which came up again and again. We have arguably one of the lowest 911 taxes in the nation. It's been 75 cents, a flat rate, since 1995, so it's not a percentage, so it hasn't grown or kept up with inflation. We have much different 911 system than we had back in the mid-1990s. And there's nothing wrong with having the lowest tax if you're actually doing the job, but we're not. We're now below 25% in terms of what the 911 tax actually funds in terms of our PSAP. So we have what we believe is a very modest proposal to increase it by 50 cents and index it to inflation. This would still keep us way low by comparison to all the rest of the states, but would help to keep us funded in terms of the advancing technology of 911. And that is done in less than 15 for both.
Where to go, Rob?
Oh, Sobering Station has a
video.
Oh, they have a video. We have a video of the Sobering Station. Okay. We have time. How long is the?
It's just a few minutes, and it's an example of a success story that was born out of our sobering.
That'd be great.
Buckley Detox is a facility that has 2 sites. One is sobering, and one is the detox site itself. Buckley is to help individuals that are physically addicted to the substance that they're using. What we offer at Buckley is we offer a way out where they can come get 24-hour medical care along with clinical care, so we can treat them in a way that they are no longer physically dependent and are ready for their next step in their recovery, which is usually a residential setting or outpatient. Kelly was like a lot of families that we've met or individuals that we've met, in the way that she showed up there with her daughter. And she was under the influence. She was very pale. You could tell that she was emotionally upset. And she didn't know what to expect. Her daughter was crying and pleading that please, can you get my mother into detox?
Well, I had been in a 5-year abusive relationship that culminated in me becoming homeless after being nearly killed by my ex-boyfriend. I was homeless on the streets, surviving every day just to drink, and drinking was all I knew. I mean, I have been an alcoholic for the majority of my life. I come from an alcoholic background, in and out of the hospital due to my alcoholism, and my family had completely given up on me. I became the thing that I used to turn away from when I saw it on the street, something subhuman. I came out only at night to buy the alcohol I needed to survive for that day.
We did everything we could to get her in because we saw how discouraged and hopeless Kelly's situation was. She had nowhere to live. She had been homeless. She could no longer stay with her daughter. Her family relationships had all been harmed by her drinking, and she had severe health issues as well.
My son-in-law put me out of his home in front of my grandchildren because he did not want me around his family. And I was in a strange place, not knowing what to do. So I hid in the bushes close to their home because I wanted to be near her and my grandchildren. And I lived in those bushes for 2 weeks over by Walmart and Wilco. Coming out and going to Walmart at night to get the alcohol I needed so I wouldn't have seizures. And it got to be so scary for me that one day I walked to her house when I knew my son-in-law was at work, and I begged her to help me because I didn't want to die. And she said yes. She let me sleep in my grandson's room that afternoon. And I believe that that's when she started the process of calling Art to get me into Buckley. And I don't know what that entailed. She did not tell me that she'd even been doing this. And then the next morning I went into Buckley. I was willing, but that's about all I was. I didn't believe that there was any hope for me because I'd been an alcoholic so long, and that's all I knew.
So people may think that this is a unique case, but the realistic piece of this is we see this every day at Buckley Detox. We get several phone calls from family members, mothers, fathers pleading that their children are using opiates or alcohol, are involved in the criminal system, are at the hospital, constantly going to the emergency rooms, and they're trying to offer them help, but the help is limited in what they're able to do. We have even children that call and ask for help for their parents, as it was the case with Kelly. And it's sad that it's not unique, but on the other side of it is it's great that we can offer the help to put these families back together, or to give them the tools so they can put their families back together.
The nursing staff here at Willamette Family is amazing. They have went over and above to make sure that I got the kind of care that I needed in every aspect of my life. I came in and I got an amazing counselor, and who helped me believe in myself, showed me that I was worth it. All the staff at Cheshire showed me that I was worth saving, that I had a right to be alive. Having outpatient facilities available, I can come in here and talk about what's going on out there in my life that isn't working and have somebody show me different ways to deal with those situations. Recovery truly begins in a lot of ways the minute you leave. I know for me, when I was in residential, it was extremely important to see somebody who was no longer inpatient, but doing outpatient, be successful. Getting a job, getting an apartment, going to meetings, being of service in the community, because that showed me that that was possible for me, that there is life after treatment, wonderful life. And that's what I have today because of Willamette Family, because of Buckley, because of the mental health services. Today, I'm proud. I'm a survivor. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. And I'm a child of God.
Every day we face a job at Buckley where we seriously get to help in saving lives. And people may think that that is just the same, but we see people that have died year after year, different names in the obituaries. I love my job because every day there's an opportunity of life.
Thank you all very much. Very telling story. And Mark and Cheryl, thank you for being representatives of this effort to try to move us forward and helping those who need help and keeping them out of the systems that they don't belong in. And resource-wise is not a wise investment. So thank you. Rob, as always,
thank you very much.
Anything else? So I do want to recognize and acknowledge the judicial branch in the back. I was wondering, I'm looking at my schedule and saying, oh, yes, CLE. So thank you all for being here and everyone else. With that, I think that is concludes. So happy holidays to all, safe travels to all, and we'll see you next year. The Senate Judiciary Interim Committee is now adjourned.
The House Committee is adjourned.
All right. You don't have to worry about that. All right. You don't have to worry about that.